You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Caden Tokuingoa. No mai, haere mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for our Pare Thursday. My name is Caden, I'm your host for today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. FRKNA coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the recent One News Varian poll and calls for a bipartisan approach to the Resource Management Act reform. For International Desk, I spoke to Professor Richard Creever, Professor of Tax Law at the University of Western Australia, about taxing tech giants with a digital services tax. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about Auckland's congestion problem, specifically relating to Mount Smart Road, as well as the funding of community-led projects through Ngā Hapori Momoho. As well, I spoke to Waikato University Bronwyn Isaacs and Māori tech expert Dr. Karaitiana Tairu on the emergence of AI and deepfakes in politics ahead of New Zealand's elections.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wari wari I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō, he pakehere rukiruki mārunga I te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Both National and Labour have gone down in the latest One News Varian poll. Two minor parties, the Greens and New Zealand First, went up. Labour leader Chris Hipkins said he's focused on building support for Labour ahead of next year's election. And regional councils are calling for more certainty and bipartisanship on regulations following announced changes to the Resource Management Act by this government. The proposed changes to the Act cover regulations on freshwater, infrastructure and the primary sector. I spoke to Labour's Shannon Halbert about both of these topics. I started by asking what he thinks drove the recent One News Varian poll results.
Well, I think it's become very clear that people aren't happy about the cut to women's pay as a result of the pay equity cancellations in this year's budget. This is one poll of a number, and they are different. And so, you know, that means the focus for me and for Labour is to focus on what we think is important to New Zealanders, which is jobs, health and homes.
Even though some of National's policies have been unpopular, like scrapping pay equity, why do you think this hasn't translated into a bump in the polls for Labour?
Well, I think New Zealanders have recognised very clearly that the leadership from Prime Minister Luxon is quite poor. That David Seymour is really leading the country in the decisions that the government is making. Labour across polls is polling reasonably well. We're up since the last election, but there's plenty more work to do. And, you know, we've got to make sure that we're just really focused on the issues that are important to New Zealanders, which is jobs, health and homes. Those aren't the things that this government is focused on, and so we've got to push on and demonstrate the leadership that the government isn't showing.
Chris Hipkins has also gone down in the preferred Prime Minister rankings. Is he still the best person to be leading Labour?
Chippy certainly demonstrates the leadership that Aotearoa New Zealand needs. He's focused on the issues that are important to people. He has held up his leadership over this period and will continue to do that. He's the best person to be the next Prime Minister, and we support him in doing so.
Are you confident that Labour can increase support ahead of the next election?
We've got a lot of work to do. We're currently working through our policy manifesto. We'll release that in the new year. That will give New Zealand a sense of what our priorities will be in the next government. But certainly we've given a strong indication that our focus will be on jobs, health and homes. You know, jobs that pay well, a health system for New Zealanders that they can rely on, and enough homes for everyone. And we've proven that in the past. We'll do it again.
Do you think the recently announced Resource Management Act reforms to cut red tape are a good thing?
No, I don't. I think it's very clear that National is undoing all of the work that Labor did in government to ensure that our rivers will be clean enough to swim in. You know, we need to push back hard on these changes. We'll be doing that in Parliament because we believe, you know, that cutting that red tape isn't going to protect our environment.
On that, is the government doing enough in terms of balancing environmental protections with development?
Oh, National is determined to allow polluters to profit from our environment, and they've demonstrated that over and over again. We can't trust them when it comes to protecting our environment.
Earlier this week, regional councils called for a more bipartisan approach to the RMA. Is this something that Labor is thinking about?
We're always open to a bipartisan approach. We did that, of course, to address the housing shortage when we were in government, the enabling housing legislation. Come election time, the National Party bailed on that and left us high and dry. So, you know, we're open to those conversations. As I understand it, the door hasn't been opened yet, and that's up to the government to open that door.
Does there also need to be more cooperation between governments and councils and communities when considering these kinds of regulations?
Certainly there needs to be coordination between the two. I think consultation with local councils and communities is really, really important. Mayor Wayne Brown has been very clear on the need for government to consult with Auckland Council and Auckland communities. We're committed to doing that as Labor. The decisions that we make centrally impact on local communities.
Can we expect Labor to reverse any of these RMA changes implemented by National?
We're currently working through our policy priorities for the next election. That's quite a democratic process for our party members. We're engaging with key stakeholders around these things, and we'll be announcing policies in election year. But people know where we have been good in government in the past. We'll continue with those values. And, you know, we look forward to sharing those priorities in the new year.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on the recent One News Varian poll and calls for a bipartisan approach to the Resource Management Act reform.
That was our weekly chat with the Labor Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Transport are seeking community feedback on a proposal for a new T3 transit lane on Mount Smart Road to relieve congestion during peak times heading towards the Royal Oak roundabout. Between better public transport systems, a time of use charge, and different ways of managing Auckland traffic, I asked Councillor Julie Ferry about how Auckland Council hopes to reduce peak time congestion as the city's population grows. I also talked to Julie Ferry about the recent allocation of funds to community-led projects through Ngā Hapori Momoho. This year, the grant, which aims to improve financial security, improve health outcomes, and grow community and intercultural connection, has approved funding for 11 community groups, 6 of which are either Māori organisations or delivering strong Māori outcomes. I start with my questions about Auckland Central congestion. The problem of Auckland traffic is a persistent and growing one, with Auckland Transport now seeking feedback on proposals to reduce congestion along Mount Smart Road, especially at the peak of commuting times. Are there any ideas that you think are particularly compelling to address this issue?
One of the things that this is part of is actually looking at things like transit lanes, which single-occupant cars can't use them, and we're more focused on high-occupancy vehicles, so often a T3 means that if you have 3 people in the car, then you can use it, but less than 3 you can't. Buses can use them, that kind of stuff. So we're looking at that for a range of roads across the island at the moment, because that's the stuff where buses and high-occupancy vehicles get stuck in the main traffic, and it undermines the efficiency of the whole system, because that moves more people than the single car traffic. So The Mount Smart stuff is part of that and will hopefully mean that, in particular from a bus system, bus routes along here, that they're able to move through a lot faster, which then in turn makes it a more attractive and effective option for people to use.
Earlier this year, Mayor Wayne Brown was advocating for a time-of-use charge to manage demand on Auckland's roads at peak times. Do you agree with this solution or generally with the necessity of imposing the responsibility of congestion onto drivers?
So I think there's definitely some benefits from you doing a congestion charge or a time-of-use charge, probably for the city centre. We've still got quite a way to go on working out what that could look like, and in particular how we could create mitigations for people who have to come into the city centre. They don't have a choice to use another mode of transport, and they may be, for example, on low income, or they're coming into the city centre to access services because of a disability, that kind of stuff, where they don't have another option. So, for example, thinking of people who are cleaning in the middle of the night, the congestion charge might be a time of day thing, not necessarily all the time. It could be that some vehicles, types of vehicles could be exempt. There's all sorts of different ways that technologically you could manage that. And these kinds of things have been really successful overseas. I think London is probably the example that most people are familiar with. One of the key things for me would be that any income from that, or a significant portion of it, needs to go towards improving the alternatives for people to use those roads to come into the area that's covered by a charge, such as improving public transport, walking and cycling connections to make those journeys so that you actually have a genuine choice, and you can choose to come in by private car and pay the congestion charge, or you can genuinely choose to use another route. That would be a necessity for me in any scheme.
Last week I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about Auckland Council's recent approval of more homes and businesses in the city centre. In the context of this congestion issue, do you think it might be better to handle Auckland's growing population by building outward rather than upward?
No, definitely not. So building outward actually has a lot of additional costs. So the further out you build the infrastructure, the more it costs. And that's the thing, building out means we have to provide roads and wastewater and drinking water and stormwater and power and fibre, and then we also have to provide new facilities out there as well. And all of that costs more. But also, because if you live further out, it may sometimes be cheaper to live further out, but then they actually end up paying a lot more in transport costs. So you actually need to look at the whole list of the cost of who you live, not just the cost of the housing alone. Also, if people are living further away, they usually produce more emissions in terms of transport, and they're trying to reduce emissions. We are trying to halve their emissions by 2030 and get to net zero by 2050. So that's if we go further out, we're building on the land that we literally use to grow our food and taking out of speculation with productive soil. Yes, there's lots of downsides of building out rather than up, and there's also lots of upsides of building up. You get a lot of benefits from having people living, it's revitalising town centre, having more people living in it and more which then in turn supports businesses. Yeah, this is a no-brainer for me. There's heaps of benefits from adopting a more compact city model. And I note that the City Centre Advisory Panel, which brings together developers and universities and City Centre residents and the mission and lots of people who are real stakeholders in the City Centre, their goal is to actually grow the City Centre residential population to 100,000. At the moment it's about 38,000-40,000, so there's a long way to go, but they see that as actually key to unlocking the potential of the City Centre, tackling the mission, making it a great place. So that's pretty compelling for us.
Moving into my next topic, last week just over $300,000 was approved for a number of community-led projects by Auckland Council's Community Committee through the funding applications for Ngā Hapori Momoho. This round received the highest number of applications, according to the General Manager for Community Wellbeing. I was wondering, does Auckland Council at all utilise or reflect on the ideas proposed through this initiative to influence other council-led community projects or services?
So one of the purposes of this fund is to recognise that sometimes communities can do things better than councils can. And so often there might be a partnership element. Sometimes these are projects that have had long-standing council support in terms of funding, but often we'll be looking for the community to deliver for their community. So take, for example, the grant for Auckland Pride, acknowledging that the rainbow community are better at working out how to do what that project is focused on, strengthening connections and wellbeing for rainbow youth, than council would be. So, but there is a lot of cross-pollination, if you like. You know, I know that quite often there'll be opportunities for people to get together and share their work, and a lot of that comes through council as their water care communities in practice, which are sort of people working across the organisation and sometimes across the broader sector on similar stuff, and so they will come together and share, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what are we learning, what are we learning, and sometimes innovate and try new things. And some of the some of the organisations that receive funds will be involved in that kind of stuff.
For those who aren't able to be supported through the funding round, are there any other ways the council offers to uplift their community-led projects and mahi?
So council has heaps of different funding opportunities, and this is obviously a really important fund. One of the challenges that we're facing at the moment is that all of our funds are being significantly oversubscribed, and a lot of local boards, which fund the really local stuff, people are desperate for funding. A lot of the big funders have also been financially hit by the downturn. Yeah, a lot of the big funders rely on Richard's investment funds to drive how much they can give each year. And so there's a real pressure in the funding space at the moment for a lot of organisations. Opposition involvement with Rupi Aotearoa, for example, who have applied for funds that in the past have had no trouble with getting. Sometimes they're successful and sometimes maybe not, partly because there's so much competition, but also because a lot of funders are shrinking the criteria so that they can make decisions when they've got way more applicants than they can deal with and less money than they suppose. So it is a really difficult time for people seeking funding to sort of change their kaupapa to match what they can get funded. And I can sort of see why you do that as a survival mechanism, but also sometimes it means you're starting to drift away from the natural purpose of the organisation, and that's a real problem in the sector. So it's a bit of a, it's been a challenging space for some years around that flourishing, but at the moment it's even more acute because so many central government opportunities have just disappeared.
I noticed that several of the grants awarded are for projects seeking to uplift the outcomes of young people. Beyond these grants, do you think that Auckland Council, or perhaps even the central government, needs to be investing more into sectors which impact young people?
I think I would probably always say yes to that question. It's a cliche, children are our future, but also I think one of the things that I've become increasingly aware of as a councillor is how we don't break intergenerational cycles of poverty, of trauma, of abuse, and how that plays out for adults. Yeah, I deal with constituents all the time who are struggling with systems, I'm usually council systems, and actually this is a generational thing. They've been dealing with this, with challenges for years, and this is just sort of the latest thing. And if we can support people at the youngest possible age, if we can give them a great start in life, we can make sure everyone feels loved and has a decent home and doesn't end up hospitalised because they live in a mouldy home and all of that stuff as children and young people. And if we can give young people and children a real safe and understand that they are citizens too and entitled to participate even if they can't vote, then the change that that can bring for us.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on Auckland peak hour congestion solutions and this year's allocation of Ngā Hapori Momoho community funding.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. And text in your thoughts, 5395.
Hot off the back of new singles Post High Slide and Brick by Brick, Mel Parsons is heading on tour, performing live at the Tuning Fork Friday, June 6th. Brick by brick,
stone by stone. The Tate Prize and AMA Album of the Year finalists will showcase new music and old favourites.
Mel Parsons, live at the Tuning Fork, Friday, June 6. Tickets available now from plus1.co.nz.
Challenge your senses in complete darkness with Darkfield, Seance and Flight in Altair Square now. Step inside two custom-built shipping containers and be transported as a strange new world unfolds around you with 360-degree audio and sensory effects that will leave you questioning reality. Darkfield, Seance and Flight. On until June 15 in Aotea Square. For tickets and more info, head to aucklandlive.co.nz.
Tap your boots together and repeat three times. There's no place like home.
Home? I don't want to go home. I want to go to Hallertau Beer Garden.
Oh, I could go for a pint, actually.
There's no place like Hallertau Beer Gardens, with cold beers, warm fires, and the best jalapeno poppers in Auckland, as voted by Iconic Eats. Plus, get those poppers at reduced pricing during happy hour every weekday from 4 till 6 p.m. Hallertau Beer Gardens in Riverhead and Clevedon. Pop in for a pint or a meal today.
Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally Wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future.
Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2026 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. Flyingout.co.nz.
You ready to play?
Yeah. I've just got to piss real quick. All right. Showtime. 95BFM Drive Live. Trillions of listeners will hear me. I'll finally make Mum proud if she listens. Maybe Freddie will listen and finally think I'm hot and cool and lovable. Oh, come on!
Hurry up!
Okay, this is it. Time to shine. Crap. No toilet paper.
Tune in every Friday live. Music beaming in direct from 95BFM Drive. Friday live on 95BFM. Thanks to McLeod's Brewery and NZ On Air.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Our go.
Global discussions are currently happening to figure out the best way to tax tech giants like Google, Facebook, and Netflix. They can make billions of dollars a year from countries where most of their profits are not taxed. To solve this, some countries like the United Kingdom and Canada have introduced a digital services tax. New Zealand came close to implementing one, but backed down over threats of higher tariffs from the United States. Australia has never even considered implementing one, despite the fact it could generate millions of dollars in revenue. There are currently growing concerns about how to balance taxing these tech giants with economic pressure from the Trump administration. I spoke to Professor Richard Creever, Professor of Tax Law at the University of Western Australia, about this topic. I started by asking what a digital services tax is and what its importance has been historically.
Well, after the Second World War, we had this
all developed countries had adopted income taxes, and we had this little problem that two countries wanted to tax the same income, basically, where a company was located wanted to tax the worldwide income, but also every country they earned profits in wanted to tax those profits, saying you got the profits here, so why shouldn't we tax them? And so to resolve that conflict, the world, at least the United Nations, the League of Nations initially, then the United Nations, then the OECD, came up with a solution. They said, here's what we'll do. We'll develop some treaties, and there's 3,000 of them in existence now. So almost, well, New Zealand, all of their trading partners, for example, are covered with treaties with New Zealand. And in the treaties, countries agreed to give up all their taxing rights over profits in the country if, from a foreign company, if the foreign company didn't operate in the company, in the country, through a what they called a permanent establishment, through a branch or a subsidiary, through some local operation. And we all agreed, every country agreed to give up all their taxing rights if they didn't operate locally, on the assumption that it'd all wash out in the long run, A, and B, the truth is, if they didn't have any permanent establishment in the country, any permanent presence, it'd be hard to tax them. They're not there. How would you tax them? So that wasn't a big problem until a decade ago when we started having cross-border digital services. And cross-border digital services means Facebook could be selling a lot of advertising space to New Zealand companies without ever having to be in New Zealand. All they have to do is have a whole bunch of people who sign up for Facebook accounts. They collect as much information as they can from those people, so they know exactly what products they're interested in, what their life interests are, and then they sell that to advertisers, saying we can target the advertisements, but they don't have to actually be in New Zealand. And now countries look at it and say, we've got a problem. We signed all these treaties, but when we signed these treaties 20 years ago, we didn't know that modern commerce would be all done over the internet, and nobody had to be in our country to make a profit. So they were stuck with the treaties, but they wanted to tax the profits. And the French came up with the idea initially. They said, okay, we're going to have something called a digital services tax, and we'll use this tax, we'll tax the income of these giant multinationals that provide services into our country. So Facebook, Google, Apple with the App Store, all of these firms, we're going to tax them using what they called a digital services tax, and said, because it's got a different name, it's not an income tax, so it's not affected by any of the income tax treaties. But that didn't really fool anybody. And the Americans in particular, since all these countries are located in the United States, basically. So the Americans came back and said, no, you're not fooling us. This is an income tax that you're calling, that you've called a digital services tax, and it's contrary to a treaty you've signed with us. And so what they, it went back and forth over, it's now been a couple of years, and what most countries have conceded is, okay, it is sort of an income tax. So as soon as you allow us to renegotiate our treaties, so we can regain our taxing rights, we'll give up the digital services tax. The United States didn't agree to renegotiate the treaties. They came pretty close. And under the Biden administration, the United States was part of a worldwide negotiation that was conducted through the OECD, but with a lot of other countries involved. And they came really close. And then the Trump administration came in and pulled out of all international agreements in tax and everything else. And so the negotiations stopped, and then Trump started saying, if you don't get rid of the digital services taxes, we'll pay you back with extra tariffs. So some countries, two countries, backed down, New Zealand being one of them, was going to bring in the digital services tax and pulled out when Trump started making threats. And India, which had one in effect, then stopped theirs. But everybody else who's had an effect, Canada and France and a lot of European countries, have stuck with it. They've kept with it. They're waiting to see if Trump's bluffing, or if they have to give it up, what exactly they can get for it.
That was actually leading into my next question quite well, which was going to be, what is holding Australia back? What has caused New Zealand to back down from implementing this kind of tax when it has been successful in places like the UK and Canada?
Yeah, well, New Zealand and Australia, it's different reasons, I think. New Zealand has a history of standing up to the Americans, actually, and then from nuclear ships to you name it. And so New Zealand seems to think it can afford to stand up to the States, and it generally has. But now you've got a government that's more worried about New Zealand exports to the United States and the tariffs, so it backed down. Australia never contemplated it. Australia is exactly the opposite of New Zealand in our relationship with the United States. We've always given them anything they want and everything they want. And it's got nothing to do with tax or like we have a free trade agreement with the United States that gives the Americans free trade into Australia and has all sorts of restrictions on Australian trade into the United States. But we don't look at these things in terms of the fiscal cost of treaties where we give up taxing rights or trade treaties and tariff treaties, because the Australian politicians think largely in terms of military arrangements with the United States and sees the US military as being responsible for Australia's military security. And we give up anything financial as long as the Americans keep Marines posted near Darwin.
Obviously, these tech giants operate across borders on a large scale. So can these domestic taxes actually make any difference in how they operate?
Yeah, well, car companies operate across borders. All sorts of companies operate, clothing companies. You walk into any shopping mall in Auckland and you'll see the exact same brands that you see in Paris and London and Lisbon. So the world today is a world of multinationals, and we are able to tax all of them. Multinational electronic commerce enterprises are a little more difficult because they don't have assets in the country that we can seize if they don't pay the tax. Everybody else, we can say you pay the tax or we take your property. And you can't do that if they're just sending in their services over the internet. But when we impose taxes on them, the digital services taxes is a good example. The U.S. government may not like the idea that the French government is taxing American companies, but they're paying the tax. They're paying the tax in all these countries. They do it under complaint, but they pay it. Amazon pays tax in Australia. The Uber pays tax in Australia. So yes, you can do it. International corporations do not evade tax. They don't break the law. If the law says they have to pay it, they'll pay it. So what they do is work within the law and take advantage of the weaknesses in the law that allow them, for example, to shift profits abroad, which is very easy to do because the laws do have so many weaknesses. But the answer to your question is, if we really wanted to tax them, yes, we could tax them.
What exactly is the level of revenue that countries could be getting from a digital services tax?
We tax companies and individuals on net profits. That is, their gross revenue doesn't really reflect their ability to pay, because you take a plumber coming to your house. The plumber charges may seem very high, but they're paying for their truck and their specialized equipment and their welding and the pipes and so forth. So we always allow them to deduct their expenses, and we only tax on the net income. And the digital services taxes, because it's not an income tax in name, they impose it on the gross revenues. So however much Facebook gets from advertising in the UK is subject to tax. However much Apple gets from people buying through the App Store is subject to tax. And they do have expenses. They've got big operations back in California. They've got expensive real estate they got to maintain back in California and so forth. So we should be taxing them on something net. We should be allowing them to deduct some of the expenses they've incurred to receive all this revenue. We don't. We tax them on the gross amount. So we pick a number that's much lower than the normal company tax rate, because we concede that it's only that part of it is only a part fraction of it is actually your gross or your real gain. And it depends what number you pick there is and how close you, what you think, how much expenses you have, which is a little bit of guesswork. But the answer is millions of dollars, because they're earning tens of millions and hundreds of millions of revenues from advertising. Basically, most of these services are advertising, except shared services where they're acting as link and businesses, linking users who need a Uber ride with the provider of that ride.
You've pretty much answered this already, but I just wanted to check, looking forward, could a change in political leadership, particularly in the United States, make implementing a digital services tax more likely?
Look, if the United States came round, the world was very close. In fact, they drafted, we had the draft rules already. We were very close to not needing a digital services tax because we were just going to change all the world's with one fell swoop. It was going to be a treaty that every country signed, and that treaty said we change all existing tax treaties in the world to allow countries to tax profits from digital services. So we wouldn't have needed the digital services tax. We would have just used all of the income taxes that everybody already has. So yes, if you had a change of political leadership, and we've got everything already, we just have to move that extra step forward. So it could be done tomorrow if there was a change of heart by the United States.
That was Professor Richard Creever, Professor of Tax Law at the University of Western Australia, on taxing tech giants with a digital services tax.
International Desk on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The proliferation of deepfakes and AI-generated content on social media sites like TikTok and Instagram is playing an ever-increasing role in political campaigns. Recent elections in Australia and the United States, among other countries, have demonstrated the role of deepfakes in representing or misrepresenting political figures, as well as spreading sensationalist mis- and disinformation on key political issues. University of Waikato anthropology lecturer Bronwyn Isaacs published a piece in The Conversation this week calling for new legislation in Aotearoa while expressing her concern of the role of AI in politics, as echoed by other academics across the globe witnessing the impact of artificially generated content on their own elections. Leading expert in Māori data, tech ethics and data governance, Dr. Karaitiana Taiuru, has also raised concern recently with the impact of AI and other emerging technologies on institutional trust and security. I talked to both Bronwyn Isaacs and Dr. Karaitiana Taiuru about the role deepfakes and AI might play in New Zealand's upcoming elections. First up is my discussion with Waikato University lecturer Bronwyn Isaacs. How have you observed deepfakes and AI-generated content influencing political engagement in New Zealand?
So I guess, I mean, it's on the rise. It's being used more and more, and it requires less and less.
Sorry, that was me putting in the wrong interview. I will just skip to the next one. This is Bronwyn Isaacs.
In recent elections around the world, AI-generated videos have played an increasingly significant role in defining social media political campaigns, especially on TikTok, which platforms short and sensational video content. What are your main concerns for New Zealand elections when it comes to deepfake political content?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, because obviously not all use of AI, whether it's on TikTok or other videos, is harmful in the same way, right? I think we see, you know, examples of even political content with AI that can be creative and funny, but not necessarily misleading or misinformation or disrespectful, right? But certainly, I think if we look forward to the New Zealand election, which is going to happen sometime next year, by that time, you know, AI capabilities in terms of producing content that looks authentic or looks believable to at least to many people is going to be much more enhanced than it is now. And there doesn't seem to be very good regulation in regards to the video content being produced for political purposes, really in most parts of the world. You know, it was interesting, I think it was last year, you know, a bunch of the tech companies got together, you know, Google, Meta, Microsoft, you know, they committed to trying to combat political misinformation online. And if you go to Meta's websites, they'll say things like they require their advertisers when producing content that's political to have a disclaimer that the content is AI generated. But when you look at what's actually happening in practice, that's definitely not happening, right? So I think like Meta kind of feels like, oh, we can wash our hands, la, la, la. We asked everyone to declare their AI use. But actually, I mean, as far as I can tell, most political parties and most political actors that are producing content aren't declaring it. And even when they are declaring it, like there was an interesting example that came up from the recent Australian election where the Liberal Party produced a very silly like AI generated video, and it comes up in their video on the first sort of few seconds of the video. This video is entirely AI generated, but they didn't actually declare that anywhere on the post, either on Instagram or where they also posted it on YouTube. And according to like Google's policies, which, you know, own YouTube, there's supposed to be like an automatic declaration that Google produces that attaches itself to YouTube videos that use AI political content. And this video was only produced a month ago. So you would think that Google would have caught up by now, but they obviously haven't. So we're in this situation where there isn't a lot of political regulation in terms of laws in most parts of the world. There isn't regulation and good practice occurring by the large tech companies. And so it really then comes down to the people creating that content to be their best ethical selves in producing political content. And in the heat of an election, I don't really like to trust the political parties. I don't know about you, but I don't trust most of the political parties to make the best decisions.
Yeah, I think those examples that you've brought up from the Australian political campaigns are really interesting. They've been creating some quite strange content on TikTok. How do you foresee that the deepfakes like those generated on this brain rot trend will influence the way voters, especially in younger generations, are able to critically engage with elections and political issues?
Well, I think that younger generations are actually better poised than older generations. And when I say younger, I mean like really younger, like I think maybe, you know, age 24 and down, because they, according to, you know, studies that I've read, the younger generations are actually more attuned to figuring out which content is AI, which is not. And, you know, the majority of everybody else has a harder time spotting which content is AI generated. So in some ways, it makes sense that a lot of the content is being produced by the younger generations, and also that they're more critical of it. And also potentially if they're present on platforms like TikTok or other social media platforms, if they're in communities where there are conversations about this, they are able to talk about it to a certain extent and highlight among themselves. So I'm actually more concerned about the older generation. You know, in terms of what they're receiving and their inability to have that tech literacy or have that AI literacy to understand what they're watching. Does that sync with what you've seen, or is there something else in particular you're getting at?
Yeah, no, I think that talking about this tech literacy is quite an important element of this discussion, because as I see, or as I would assume, I'd say younger generations kind of have a better grasp on what is real and what is fake, or maybe take certain things with a grain of salt a bit more on that they see on social media. I'm interested to know, especially in relation to who is kind of educated on, or who kind of has that tech literacy that we're talking about, are there any groups that you would say are going to be disproportionately affected by the proliferation of AI-generated political deepfakes, especially in New Zealand's upcoming election campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously when we think about older Australians, we've seen, sorry, older New Zealanders and Australians, I'm thinking about Australia a lot at the moment. But when we think about the older generations, you can see how they've been very susceptible to scams online, romance scams, financial scams, you know, the Hey Mum classic scam, post office scams, all of these things. I think it's very reasonable to assume, and also based on the current studies that we've seen, that it's going to be the older generations that are are more at risk in terms of maybe believing the fake content that's being produced. But to turn the question around another way, if we think about vulnerability, it's not just who's at risk of being taken in and not understanding what they're seeing. It's also at the risk of who is going to be marginalized and disrespected in the creation of this content. Because if we have, for example, synthetic fakes of minority communities from Aotearoa, this can be done in a way that's like incredibly disrespectful to communities in New Zealand that are already experiencing forms of, you know, political marginalisation. So, you know, the whole idea that, you know, you would put an image of, say, a Pacific nurse up on an advertising ad, and that image is not even of a real person, but just a synthetic that's created from a bunch of different people. You know, according to the people I've interviewed and talked to, for many people, that it feels incredibly disrespectful because you're not engaging with them as community, engaging with their stories and what they've experienced in Aotearoa. You're just creating a complete fake version of them. So even if they know that it's fake, what matters to them is the fact that they haven't been consulted or representative in a genuine way in that form of representation.
Mis and disinformation have already been aspects of politics that democratic citizens have had to learn to navigate, especially in the age of social media, but even preceding this. In what ways does mis or disinformation have worse consequences when it is generated through deepfakes and AI content?
Okay, so let me make sure I got that question. You're saying there's been misinformation, disinformation for millennia, right, or just forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are the increased risks in terms of misinformation and disinformation today? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like, what makes it worse when it's produced through deepfakes? Or, like, is there an exacerbated effect of it because it is through deepfake or AI content or whatnot?
Sure. I mean, I guess there's multiple ways to look at it, right? On the one hand, you can look at how easy it is to create content that is manipulative to people who don't understand that they're looking at deepfakes. And on the other hand, as I said, you have the increased capacity to disrespect people's cultural content, their personal copyright, and the, you know, the sovereignty that they have over their communities and culture by sort of taking their images, taking their stories, taking their content and just playing with it without actually truly engaging with those communities. So, I mean, obviously there's always been people who have been scammers. There's always been people who have been fakes throughout. You know, there's a very famous, like, band from the 1980s, which people love to point to, called Milli Vanilli. They were, like, this German band who, like, had these very popular songs, and people were outraged when they found out that they were lip-syncing the entire time, and it wasn't them singing the song. So they had two guys, like, who were the front, you know, image of the band who would go on stage and sing the songs and be on all the album covers. And then they had other people who were singing the songs behind the scenes. And this is like, you know, an old theme. It's in like classic films, like The Sound of Music and all of those things. So we've had these forms of, you know, when we had AI impersonating Joe Biden in the latest American election. I mean, that was shocking to people, but we've had these forms of technology that misrepresent people and convincingly do so for many, many you know, centuries, if not longer. So it's certainly, yes, something that's been around with us forever and will continue to evolve as technology continues. And I think what's really pertinent for this moment and, you know, people of this generation or of this political moment is to think about the particular ethics that are provoked by AI, particularly when there isn't any sort of clear regulation on it, either corporate regulations through the tech companies or regulation, you know, in terms of laws in New Zealand requiring any form of declaration around the use of AI or anything like that. So I think we need to quickly catch up in New Zealand. I think it would be great if the tech companies quickly caught up and actually did what they said they were going to do. But, you know, we can't rely on them. So we also need laws in New Zealand regulating the use of AI, because I don't think we can trust the individual political pundits online or the, you know, political parties to do the right thing.
Yeah, that's a really important point. It works well with my last question, which was kind of observing the effect of deepfake content on recent elections across the globe in places like Australia, the United States and Canada and South Korea and the response from these governments to this influence on political elections, what would be your specific recommendations to the central government in terms of legislative change or even education on this issue, particularly in the lead up to our own national election next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's imperative for the government to consider regulations requiring political posts on social media or other forms of media, if for that in that case, that use forms of generative AI, to have clear labeling. I mean, we have clear labeling on things like tobacco products or junk food, or like, you know, that, you know, it's there's different laws about how much that labeling occurs. So we need to have a debate about, you know, to what extent that labeling should be there. But that would be the first thing. Absolutely has to be labeling when there's generative AI, particularly when it's, you know, producing forms of deepfakes that could be potentially a bit manipulative. And then beyond that, we need to think about, well, what are the impacts for things like copyright, like taking other people's content and then using that for political gain without fair attribution. Yeah, there's a range of issues that can continue, that we need to continue to work out. But I would say number one is that declaration. And then, as in some countries, there may even be a ban on using or producing generative content in the lead up to an election. So you might put a ban in, you know, a couple of months in advance, and only allow people to, you know, be more, a bit more playful with the AI after the election's finished.
Next up, I spoke to Māori data and tech expert Dr. Karaitiana Tairu about how we should respond to the emergence of AI in politics in Aotearoa. How have you observed deepfakes and AI-generated content influencing political engagement in New Zealand?
So I guess, I mean, it's on the rise. It's being used more and more, and it requires less and less skills to be able to do it. As you know, I mean, when deepfake technology was first around, it was, you know, relatively complex to do it. But yep, I am seeing political attacks on all the main parties. A lot of misogynist attacks on female politicians. And probably an increase in attacks on Te Pāti Māori with those deep fakes and having different politicians saying different things and doing different things. Yeah, I hope that most people realise that they are deep fakes, that, you know, our politicians wouldn't say and do some of those things that are emerging in deepfakes.
What are your main concerns around the use of deepfakes in political campaigns and produced during election periods on social media, perhaps in particular with regard to how it impacts Māori data and data sovereignty?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I think we've learnt from the elections in America and other countries in the world that this will be an issue. And we do know that minorities will be targeted. So Māori in particular are most likely going to be targeted with misinformation campaigns. It's likely we're going to see an influx of that sort of misinformation about asking Māori not to vote for different groups, and we're going to see a lot of targeting of anti-treaty propaganda. I think it's all going to be a quite a serious issue that we need to start addressing now. And I mean, to me, the simple solution would be if we had organisations like NetSafe with the authority to talk to places like Facebook and other social media and just have that stuff removed. But we don't have that. So, the implications could be quite wide and varying. And, for New Zealand and for Māori, I think next year is going to be a wake-up call for us as to what the damage is and how we can prevent it in the future. As I said, next year will be our first time we're going to see the sort of online attacks and these online campaigns.
What are some of the changes you think AI will have for Māori culture and the way, and as well, and the way that Māori can meaningfully engage in the political system in Aotearoa?
So I think there's a lot of fear, a lot of misinformation about AI in Māori communities. That's created, mistrust. So I think the first thing that we need to do is actually look at AI and say, yes, there are some detriments here, but there's a whole lot of positives. And we could use AI to up the voter registration of Māori in communities. We could use AI to create informative campaigns based on facts and, you know, things that, you know, the younger generations, you know, would actually want to watch and engage with, and we get key messages out that way. So, yeah, so again, I think, yeah, there's positives and negatives for everything with AI, but, yep, I think, yeah, we could definitely use it as a positive for participation in political voting, whether it's local or central voting.
Do you think there's enough education or resources, especially for Māori voters, but probably more widely in New Zealand, for people engaged in New Zealand politics anyway, relating to fake content and mis- or disinformation which can be spread online?
My professional opinion and my personal observations are we don't have enough knowledge, we don't have access to resources to understand the actual real impacts of what's happening out there. There's some horrific, you know, viral stuff goes on the internet, and people don't either understand it or talk about it. So some of the issues we have is trying to prosecute under New Zealand legislation is very difficult. People who see it probably don't want to talk about it. Maybe they've clicked into somewhere they, you know, don't want to publicly admit they were at. I think for other people, they think it's just a joke, but definitely a large sector of our population just, yeah, they have no idea of what's really happening online.
You recently spoke on Wātea News about a Russian disinformation network's exploitation of AI chatbots to produce pro-Kremlin propaganda content, especially produced in Te Reo Māori. Can you talk a little bit more about what happened here and maybe any concerns you have about the influence of external factors or external political influences, I suppose, impacting New Zealand's political outcomes?
Yeah, definitely. So in that case, in that instance, it was a Russian media website, and basically their propaganda or their media articles were translated into Te Reo Māori with AI. Language experts who read those articles said it was accurate. As far as they could tell, it was written by a human. So, we have to be careful when we're reading sites that are written in Te Reo Māori, making sure that they are New Zealand-based. And, yeah, I think just, yeah, being, I think everybody should just be cautious of what they do read online. Anyone can write anything and put it online. And I think in the past five or so years, we've seen a lot of misinformation about numerous things. There was, vaccine information, political figures. I think, we just have to be really cautious. I think external influences, I think if we had, white supremacy groups with international affiliations, we could, it's possible to that we could start seeing, external influences like that. It's also possible if there's a foreign country wants to disrupt the election process. We know that's happened already around the world. So again, I think, we need to be prepared for that. But I feel quite confident that we've got people in different security agencies in New Zealand who do do a lot of work behind the scenes to protect New Zealanders from that sort of foreign influence.
Yeah, we've got academics and people all over the world kind of starting to notice how AI and deepfakes can have a negative impact on political outcomes or on election seasons or election campaigns. But you've talked a little bit here about the positive influence as well of AI. What would be your recommendations to the central government in terms of both responding to the threats of AI and harnessing its benefits in New Zealand in the coming years?
Yeah, so for the threats, I think, we need to have better legislation that actually makes deepfakes either illegal or regulated. And we need to give authority or more power to the likes of NetSafe New Zealand, the police, and various other agencies. In terms of, using it to our benefit, I mean, it's, to me, we could use it as the same way we use a television advert. But have disclaimers that, this is AI generated. But then, just really play on our younger people's, their interests and what is their normal day-to-day activities, and use the AI to, as a form of advertising and promoting, factual information. And, I think it's relatively easy to do, and I think there'd be a lot of benefits there. especially for people who don't engage with mainstream media, who probably will just end up, you know, using social media and all the disinformation that's there already. So definitely, yeah, I think using AI for advertising in those spaces would be of great benefit.
That was Māori tech expert and chair of Kahui Māori at the AI Forum in New Zealand, Dr. Karaitiana Taiuru, and University of Waikato anthropology lecturer Bronwyn Isaacs on how New Zealand should prepare for the proliferation of deepfakes and AI during political elections.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.